Hey, Blenders, it's Sean, and we are here with a bonus episode for you guys. This is not a full episode. It's not going to get a number. It doesn't necessarily count toward the overall count of episodes. But we were lucky enough to sit down with director Robert Eggers, who is out promoting his new film, The Lighthouse. It is a crazy movie-going experience with a lot of different ways to interpret it. So when we had an opportunity to sit down and talk with him about this anticipated film, because it's opening in a lot of theaters near you, we wanted to jump on it. We were seeing on social media that a couple of you guys were checking out The Lighthouse over the weekend, so we didn't necessarily want to wait and post this in a full episode. We wanted to make it a bit of bonus content to deliver to the Blender family. So without further ado, here is our bonus episode with Robert Eggers, the director of The Lighthouse. All right, guys, it brings me great pleasure to introduce Robert Eggers, who's joining the Real Blend podcast to promote his new film, The Lighthouse. It's making its way to theaters everywhere. Hi, Robert. How are you doing?
Great. Just in a fugue state, a press fugue state.
I'll try to hit you with things that you have not heard before. I'm curious because after The Witch, almost instantly, the idea of a quote-unquote Robert Eggers film really intrigued a lot of people. And it built up to momentum, you know, for this movie. As Lighthouse started coming up, everyone sort of said, I want to see what he's going to do as a follow-up. But I think the movies that you make are really unlike most of what we see. So I'm just curious to go back and see what filmmakers kind of opened your eye to cinema. Who were the filmmakers who you made sure you saw their movies, you know, opening weekend in a theater?
I mean, the filmmakers who inspired me the most, I never got an opportunity to see any of their movies opening weekend because they're all dead. You know, growing up, obviously, like it was Star Wars and Spielberg and Disney that got me excited about the idea of telling stories. But then, well, I guess David Lynch isn't dead, but you know, you see Eraserhead at the bottom of dusty shelf of the whatever section of the video store in rural New Hampshire, and you understand, oh, there's, you can do other things, you know, because I mean, I admire a lot of Tim Burton movies from the sort of first and middle part of his career more so. But, you know, he was, before seeing real art cinema, like the weirdest director on my radar, you know. Even though I don't like the last act of Sleepy Hollow, I would love to just live in that village.
it's an amazing production for sure.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's Bergman, it's Dreyer, it's Tarkovsky, it's Murnau, it's Cassavetes, Parajanov, Kurosawa, stuff like that. You know, the people who are, I mean, if a Claire Denis movie comes out, I want to see that opening weekend, you know. When a Jennifer Kent movie comes out, I want to see that opening weekend. If a Terrence Malick movie comes out, I want to see that opening weekend. If a Michael Haneke movie comes out, I want to see that opening weekend.
And now sometimes your films are playing alongside of them, which is fantastic. People go see A Hidden Life and The Lighthouse in one double feature if they wanted to.
That's wild.
Yeah, it is. You know, The Lighthouse world premiered in Cannes. I managed to see it in Toronto. I saw The Witch up in Toronto, too. You bring your films through the fall, the film festival circuit, not necessarily the fall film festival circuit, but just the film festival circuit in general. Talk to me a bit about just the process of bringing your movies through the film festival initially, and how, you know, the days that we see them, people might be seeing a lot of different films. Sometimes they're rushing to judgment and then hurrying off to another film. You know, what is that scenario like in terms of getting really good feedback and trying to get an idea of how it plays with a crowd?
I mean, you know, before the first screening of The Witch and before the first screening of The Lighthouse, I was quite terrified because you don't know how it's going to go. And I mean, really, like, I was way more terrified about The Lighthouse than The Witch because I didn't have very high expectations for The Witch. And so if people kind of like didn't hate it. I was excited about that. But then The Witch was shockingly to me successful and found an audience. So then, you know, I'm nervous to have my wife, who I read the first 10 pages of something that I've written, because it's scary to put yourself out there. But then there's all these expectations about The Witch, and, you know, people put money into this movie is less commercial than The Witch and costs more. Like there, it's, you know, it's never, you know, it's a lot of pressure. I mean, I'm not complaining about it. It's just the truth. It's sure. Just the truth. So yeah, but then it was because it was received fairly warmly. That was nice, and it's fun. It's fun to go to film festivals. It's fun, but a little, like, it was more fun when I was making short movies that no one saw, because I had time to watch other people's films. But, you know, when I go to a film festival, I'm just doing press, and then I don't get to see anything. And you know, Toronto was a little bit less disappointing to miss stuff, because pretty much everything in Toronto, like, I can see it's anyway. But, you know, when you're at Cannes, you want to, like, who's the next Carlos Regattas? Who's the next Bruno Dumont? Like, where's their weird movie that might not get distribution in the United States, and my only, like, chance to see it is at Cannes? Like, and I didn't get to see anything like that, which is a real shame.
Yeah. Whose review, either personal or professional, of The Lighthouse meant the most to you to hear it or to read it?
Well, you know, a lighthouse keeper came to a screening in Halifax, and directors, you don't tend to want to have, when it's an audience Q&A, comments, you tend to want to have, like, actual questions. But sure. This lighthouse keeper said, you know, I worked in a lighthouse before my lighthouse station became automated, and you guys really captured something real here. So that was pretty cool. Defoe was there for that, and we were like, yeah, nice.
that's awesome. I think a lot of first-time filmmakers, up-and-coming filmmakers, people who are trying to get into the business would automatically make the assumption that The Witch and the success that it enjoyed opened up a lot of doors in terms of what you could do for your follow-up project. And I'm curious if that's accurate. What is the success like a film like The Witch does open up a lot in terms of the next thing that you get to do? Do people come to you and say, we really want to be in business with you, what stories do you want to tell, or is it still a fight each movie?
It's both things. You know, it's like 10 minutes after I won the director award at Sundance, someone was calling my agent about, like, trying to get me to do some big studio franchise thing, which is insane. I mean, you know, it just shows you how fickle and crazy the business is. They had never seen my movie. You know, I mean, they weren't, it's not like they were offering me the job. It was like to begin a conversation, but, you know, sure. But yeah. Yeah, so there were people who were offering me stuff like that and things like that, and then I had the opportunity to, you know, develop some of my own things that were bigger, and I chose to do that rather than working on other people's IPs. I guess Nosferatu is someone else's IP, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. But those are struggles to get made, you know. The Lighthouse was strangely less of a struggle because A24 wanted to work with me again. RT Features wanted to work with me again. Regency been trying to find something, and so it was a good team of people to do this. I mean, but you know, yeah.
I know that our listeners are going to lose their minds over the look of the film. And it's beyond just the 4:3 ratio, the decision to shoot black and white, just the grain. We talk about grain on our show more than anything else, and film stock versus, you know, digital. But I'd read you shot with lenses that were from 1918. Is that right?
Yeah, I actually misspoke. Our earliest lens was from 1905. the DP's in the same room as me. He just said to me, was it maybe even 1903? But there, our main set of lenses was designed in the 30s. And, so we were, you know, the 1905 lens on, or 1903 lens only came out for lumberjack, flashbacks. So respectfully, we actually shot the movie in a more narrow aspect ratio than 4:3. We were shooting in 1:19:1, which is like an early sound aspect ratio. Obviously on the surface, that aspect ratio, the black and white to like an audience member who's not familiar with film history, it's still just says old. It says old, you know? Great.
Yeah, sure.
But also it's, you know, that aspect ratio is better for shooting vertical structures like a lighthouse tower. It's better for communicating cramped interiors like where they live. And it's better for shooting close-ups of Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson's incredible faces. Why would you want a bunch of flab on the side? It's there's no point to it. Right. Because that we're shooting with spherical lenses, the frame is actually taller than it appears like a box in a CinemaScope screen, which is how everyone's going to experience it. But we're using more of the negative. We're using more of the lens. So when we're just shooting with these old lenses, we're using more. We have more of the lens characteristic on screen. We tested a bunch of film stocks, but we shot on Kodak XX, which is a black and white film stock that hasn't changed since the late 50s. And, the blacks sort of bottom out suddenly in a way that's very satisfying. It has nice micro contrast and toothy grain, and it is kind of flat and primitive, and but in a way that helps the crusty, dusty, rusty, musty atmosphere of the movie and communicates the bleakness and austerity of their lifestyle and this island much better than, if we'd shot digital with color. We couldn't have gone much more extreme in the other direction, but, you know, color didn't help us out. I mean, Robert Pattinson's been saying that, which he's got a point, you know, which is why I'm repeating it, that the interior of the keeper's cottage was kind of nice looking. Like if you cleaned it up a bit, like you'd want to live there. It could be a double RL photo shoot location, and his olive oilskin jacket, you could probably buy something like that at Filson, you know what I mean? So having it be in black and white really communicates the misery of the world.
Did your leads get behind all the effort you put in to capture that look? Or to them, was it really just, you know, give the performance and then let you sort of manipulate that image or play around with it to find it in the lighting and the capturing it through the lenses?
Well, I mean, it's nothing they really need to concern themselves with. They're excited by it. I think that what was more their problem was that, Jaron Blaschke, the DP, and I are like designing the movie before they arrive in Nova Scotia. So when we have rehearsals, it's not to find performances. It's for them to learn their blocking in relation to the camera. And that, you know, I think that there's, they understood that that's the game they had to play in this movie. And right. Sometimes it's frustrating and sometimes it's helpful. But it's just part of the parameters with which they have to perform.
Sure. I've read your actors say that there isn't a lot of improvisation, that they stick really close to the
script.
There's
no improvisation in a Robert Eggers movie.
Yes, exactly. Well, and you've said you don't shoot a lot of coverage, you know, that you get the footage that you essentially need.
There is no coverage. You know, the only time there's coverage, I mean, it's never, first of all, it's never traditional coverage, like ever. The only time that it's like coverage is if it's like, you know, shot reverse shot. You know, we cover both sides. But there's no like, you know, I mean, like the wide shots of a scene are only as long as we know we're going to play in a wide. There's no like, you know. And obviously you can see like that there is some long oneers in the movie and that and sure. And then but I think we also, you know, Spielberg, when he does his oneers, like always makes sure to have a little insert that can like save the day. And we haven't done that. Maybe if we had like more time, we might try that, but we never have any time. So we couldn't. So basically, that means that like usually it works, but sometimes me and Jaron are painting me and Louise Ford, the editor, into a corner in post. And we're like, how the hell are we ever going to dig ourselves out of this? But we figure it out. And that's fun too. You know, that's fun too, trying to solve that problem.
Well, that's a question I was going to ask too. Was there ever a time on The Witch where you filmed what you wrote, but then you just kind of realized that it off the page, it didn't play the way you thought it might, or it didn't work the way that you conceived it, and you kind of just realized you had to sort of. And how do you course correct if that's the case?
I mean, there's always pickup shoots. If you know, which we didn't have pickups on The Lighthouse. We had like some additional seagull photography and some. Additional white pines floating towards Robert Pattinson photography. But yeah, I mean, you know, you can always reshoot something if you have to. But I think, I mean, we had a Canadian hair in The Witch that didn't work. And so we needed to recast and reshoot the hair with a better, more trained hair. In that was from
hair like, well, I'm sorry, Canadian hair, what is that?
H-A-R-E.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha.
I mean, the breed wasn't from Canada, but it was living in Canada, trained by a Canadian animal trainer. But we found a young woman who lived in Connecticut, who had a hare named Dizzy, who had the hair under control. Hopefully in The Witch, there was a couple scenes that we like reshot, when we were there. Like there was one scene, that I was shooting. I shot like really, 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 really quickly. Like as in the pace was really quick. And when we saw the dailies, realized like, oh, like that's not how we should do this. We need to reshoot it again at a slower tempo.
Gotcha.
But with The Lighthouse, like, you know, that wasn't happening, and we were more planned and experienced.
A tighter unit like that. This is going to sound like a horribly goofy question. But one of my co-hosts would kill me if I didn't ask this. He can't be here right now because he's doing junkets. How do you replicate the sound of farts on screen?
I mean, you know, how do you know we replicated the sound so far?
I think that's the right answer. There you go. I have to ask about the ending, but I clearly won't ask any specifics. It's one of those films that it feels like every festival audience, every audience member coming out of The Lighthouse is going to have their own translation of it. Are you hearing a lot of translations of it? And do you have a clear-cut answer to what the ambiguous ending is?
You need to have answers to all the questions to write it. So my brother and I, like, did. But we also designed it in a way that it would, like, ask questions rather than provide answers, to use the old cliche. You know, there were versions of the script that were too clear, and we needed to find ways to create roadblocks and stumbling blocks for the audience and for Robert Pattinson's character. But yeah, I mean, any interpretations fine with me. I haven't heard any wrong interpretations yet, I think.
No such thing as a wrong interpretation, right?
There might be, but I haven't heard one yet.
Well, I'll get you out of here on this last question then, Robert. And again, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
It's my pleasure.
We love the movie. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
But, you know, your leading man, having worked with Robert now, is moving on to a huge franchise. What was your reaction when you found out he was going to wear the cape and cowl as Batman?
I think it's great. I mean, I think he'll do a good job. He's making me buy a ticket to a comic book movie again. So good for him. Though maybe he'll invite me to a screening. but I think, you know, the hope is that Rob, after Batman, will still want to do interesting work. And if Batman works out the way he hopes, you know, how cool would that be to have a movie star who like really means something in the box office and is a fucking incredible actor? It could be very good for the Eggers and the Safdies of the world.
Absolutely.
So, like, yeah, you wear that cape, Rob.
Have you seen Uncut Gems yet?
Not yet. I haven't seen anything because I'm doing this. I'm prepping my next movie, and I have a 1-year-old. So.
Oh gosh! Oh my gosh! I'm surprised I got you for 20 minutes. Listen, I mean, there are a lot of stuff to go see, but go out of your way to see Uncut Gems. It is.
No, of course. I desperately want to see it. Yeah.
Oh, God, it's so good. All right, Robert, thank you again for your time, man. I really appreciate it.
Okay, bye. Thanks.
Naturally, we want to thank A24 for setting up this interview with Robert Eggers. We want to tell everybody to go out and support The Lighthouse. It's, again, one of the most interesting films that I've seen in theaters. It has two towering performances by both Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. And I know that you guys definitely appreciated all of his talk about film stock, aspect ratios, and the way that he brought this film to life. Robert Eggers also directed The Witch. If you guys have not seen that, go check it out. They'd make a crazy double feature somewhere down the line. And again, thanks to Robert Eggers for coming on Real Blend. Check us out. We'll be back with episode number 90 later on this week, where we're diving into Terminator Dark Fate, some Irishman talk, and a lot of questions about the future of Star Wars. So be sure to join us then, when I'll be joined by Kevin and Jake and Gabe. See you guys then. Dunkirk?
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.